This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box, your podcast source for all things about genre films from the VHS era. We traverse the dusty shelves of your mom-and-pop video store searching for that hidden treasure. Some people may turn their nose up at a film with the title Mountaintop Motel Massacre, but we blow the dust off it and give it a good home right here at Go Home in a Box. I'm one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week we will have a review of the George Romero classic zombie film Dawn of the Dead. It's a classic for many reasons, and we'll hit on a few of those reasons at RetroMovieNerd this week. Joining me, as always, is a man who was sent back in time to assassinate Hitler, but instead indirectly caused the creation of Steve Urkel. It's the Ayatollah of pop cultura, Joel La Puma.
Boy, that's one of the most depressing ones you've done so far. Not that there's anything wrong with Urkel. I mean, my God, he's an American treasure. But
we will agree to disagree on that one, Joel.
Actually, a friend of mine from my grad program was a writer on Family Matters.
Oh, my goodness. I hope they sent him back to school. No offense.
you leave Family Matters alone. Rachel Bell Johnson is a saint.
Yeah. Well, I liked him in Die Hard, but, I think I'm not a TGIF guy. Sorry, Joel.
I might have just been the right age for it. I mean, realistically, most of those shows were kind of crap. I mean, I guess you'd say Sabrina's a pretty quality show, but that's a bad. And even as a kid, I still thought Boy Meets World was lame.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good hanging with Mr. Cooper joke right now.
Well, that was the best of all.
And there's your joke. Thank you.
No, hanging with Mr. Cooper was awesome.
Anyways, how are you doing this week, Joe?
Doing great. Just want to give a quick shout out to the Mahoning Drive-In in Pennsylvania. We just saw Bride of Frankenstein, the Wolfman, there Friday night on 35mm.
Awesome.
Of course, they ran a lot of trailers because they're short. They're fairly short movies. They ran a lot of trailers, a lot of old drive-in ads, weird stuff. I mean, the usual, like, let's go to the lobby, get some snacks stuff. But, like, I didn't realize how much, like, old theatrical reels had, like, public service announcements. Like, hey, don't play in the road, kids. Like, there were literally ones about looking both ways before you cross the street, things like that.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Oh, it was fantastic. On Saturday we didn't go because it's a bit of a drive. It's about 2 hours from us. They did Invisible Man, the Mummy. They've got some great stuff coming up. First weekend of October, we're going to see Monster Squad and Night of the Creeps there. I think they've got coming up late in August, their annual Camp Blood two night marathon. They're doing, I think, Friday 13th 1 and 8. They're Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3, and maybe even the first one. I don't remember. Summer Camp Nightmare. I think maybe one.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. You know, I wish they did something like that around here. I mean, there's a lot of East Coast listeners for the show, and so that's something that they should be interested in checking out.
Oh, definitely. I highly recommend. It's a really fun place to go. They have an amazing snack bar where you can buy old VHS tapes. It's covered
with
posters for old monster movies. Just the whole night is phenomenal.
Oh, man. Speaking of VHS movies, just this week I picked up Mr. Majestic on VHS.
Yes.
And Terminal Man with George Segal. And I've got an old Key video copy of Phantom of the Paradise coming, so I'm pretty excited.
Oh, that's nice. Oh.
Yeah. So my collection is starting to fill up, Joel.
It really is.
Yeah. speaking of collections, we got a couple coming out this week in the new release section, so let's mosey on over there and get right down to it. I want to mention that Echo Bridge has put yet another Walmart discount bin collection. Well, soon to be, anyway. They start off at like $10 a pop, but pretty soon you'll be finding it in the $5 bin in no time. Usually if you go to Walmart and you look through that bin and you find like like 10 movies, they're usually Echo Bridge and they're usually pieces of crap. but you know, this one's notable. It's got the great title of 19 Action Movie Collection. And it's filled
with... They're really straying themselves for titles.
Yes, they are. It's filled with, you know, a mix of 70s and 80s martial arts films. Too numerous to mention because there's 19 movies. Some latter-day Chuck Norris, like The President's Man and President's Man Line in the Sand. some latter-day Steven Seagal stuff, whatever he's doing over in Russia these days with Putin. By the way, have you seen that picture of Putin going fishing shirtless?
I have seen him hunt and ride horseback shirtless. I have not seen him fish shirtless yet. Yeah, that's the next in my, I guess, my Putin shirtless checklist.
Yeah, I think Steven Seagal was the one who took the picture.
Oh, my God. When are they going to do, like, a trading card set of, like, the best Vladimir shirtless moments?
Yeah, I'm sorry that, you know, in WWE, Rusev and Lana broke up, and, you know, because when their references to Putin were pretty awesome. And so, yeah, I kind of miss that.
You know, it seems like that gimmick is nowhere near run its course, considering...
Oh, they could bring that back now.
Every news story in the past, like, 6 months, like, how could you not keep running with that gimmick?
They could bring that back now. Of course, we all know that they're trying to avoid controversy in WWE these days. Nothing interesting going on there. Anyway, that's another story for another podcast. That's not this one. So, looking for another release here. We got from the Warner Brothers archive from 1974. It's an early 70s version of the buddy cop genre film with James Caan, Alan Arkin, two very respectable actors in my own viewpoint. It's Freebie and the Bean. Now, I haven't seen this one, Joel, but it can't be all that Batman and Arkin involved.
I can't. It's at least like not worth a look. I know it's a bit more of a comedy, or at least more comedic than than a lot of other buddy cop films from the '70s. But you know, it seems like at least worth a watch with those two involved. It does have directed by Richard Rush, who I believe directed The Stuntman and wrote it.
Yeah, so there's some quality work going on there off camera as well. So, yeah, it's probably worth a look, definitely. We're looking at Scream Factory's got a couple of releases coming out this week. The first one, a double feature Blu-ray, A couple of horror films from, I think they're also from 1974, both of them. The Night of the Sorcerers, double feature with the Laura Lee's Grasp. Both films I'm not familiar with. I hadn't heard of them until this, until the announcement of this set coming out.
Yeah, I think these are Spanish films. They're both directed by Armando de Osorio, the writer and director of the Blind Dead films.
Oh yeah, okay. So yeah, so definitely got kind of like the foreign feature film going on here.
Yeah, so I mean, they're I haven't seen either of these. I've seen most of the Blind Dead films and enjoy them. You know, these I'd imagine are probably going to be similar in style. I'm curious about this one. You know, Osorio, like Blind Dead films, they're, you know, they have cool imagery. They're moody. They're a mixture of like sort of hypnotic and sort of asinine.
Yeah.
And I'm expecting these to be. I'm curious to see what he's going to do with more mystical kind of concepts. Blind Dead, I mean, it does have that element. I mean, the fact that it's like Knights Templars. Says the zombie, like, that's amazing imagery. So I'm expecting some cool imagery and atmosphere, and probably some terrible acting, and
maybe some bad dubbing as well.
Oh, no doubt.
that's the thing with me though, is when you're watching maybe one of these Italian films or a Mexican or Spanish film with the dubbing, sometimes that can take me out of it a little bit, because, you know, you're not getting the actor's natural voice and, you know, vocal reactions to end scenes. And so, you know, the dubbing part of it, you know, it's just one of those things with me, is a sticking point with me with watching some of these, you know, just for that reason.
No, I totally get you. Like, that's something where, for me, that's very film dependent. Like, if it's a film I'm really serious about, the dubbing I always feel like the dubbing is a major impediment. But especially for like weirder atmospheric Italian and Spanish horror films, I feel like the dubbing adds an extra element of surrealism, like sort of a disconnect from reality. Like, even when it's the actors overdubbing the performances, usually the overdubbing itself is so weird that I'm always kind of entranced by how disconnected everything is.
Yeah.
Like, I think that actually for something like Blind Dead, or I especially think of Fulci's films, it always enhances it for me.
Well, I mean, I see what you're saying there. It's kind of like, you know, if there's a film that's supposed to take on some like nightmare or dreamlike quality to it in terms of atmosphere, I guess the dubbing can kind of add to that, you know, that nightmare or dream aspect of it, where, you know, maybe someone's voice isn't quite right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's always that's the feeling it adds for me. Like, if I were watching something that was a more grounded film, I think it would really bother me. But something like a Blind Dead film, like, it actually just adds to it for me.
Yeah, okay, pretty cool. Scream Factory is also putting out another double feature this week with Teen Wolf, Michael J. Fox, and Teen Wolf 2 with Jason Bateman. Now, I have a preference here. I'm partial to, of course, the first Teen Wolf with Michael J. Fox, because just basically I think he had 100 times more the charisma than Jason Bateman.
Oh, yeah. I mean, going from Michael J. Fox to Jason Bateman is, I mean, that's like a mountainous step down. And I think these are actually separate releases, not a double feature. They're both collector's edition.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. My bad.
I'm not sure if they're going to do like a double feature of these. I wouldn't be surprised after the initial, you know, order period wears off. But I mean, Teen Wolf. I mean, Michael J. I don't think it's as good as Michael J. Fox. Just, I think a lot of Michael J. Fox's movies aren't as good as he is. even if Mojo Nixon says he's the only man on earth to have no Elvis in him.
Oh my goodness, Mojo Nixon. Yeah, well, these are the guys that say was it Debbie Gibson is pregnant with my two-headed love child?
Well, I mean,
I think
yeah,
that's like, the only Moto Nixon song I'm familiar with.
Oh, I have albums. I will send you copies.
Awesome. What about from Shriek Show coming out this week is Tenement, which I've actually caught in the past. It's quite the interesting little forgotten gem. Basically, the plot is a street gang overruns a tenement building, and the residents decide that they want to fight back. So this, you know, when we talked about revenge films way back, this probably should have been on the list, I think, because you know there's quite a amount of blood to be spilled in this movie.
Yeah, this is one I've been meaning to see for the longest time, and actually, when it first came out, I believe it was X-rated.
Yeah, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, actually, a female director, Roberta Findlay, I've always meant to see some of her stuff. I mean, she's done some, you know, a lot of cinematography work, directed a lot of films, you know, a lot of very, I think she did a lot of porn in the 70s, a lot of, like, very cheap exploitation stuff in the 80s, Blood Sisters, Primeval. Tenement seems to be her most well-known one, and it seems like a really interesting sort of Assault on Precinct 13-ish take on the revenge genre.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. You know, the original Assault on Precinct 13 kind of calls back to that in quite a few scenes. That's actually a good call on that, so... you can definitely see the influence of that film in this one.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, it's fun. I think this Tenet was, what, 85, was it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, which so it actually predates Demons 2, which has a very similar structure by a year.
Yeah, so this one's definitely a curiosity to check out. And I think it's quite a good film, you know, that seems to have been forgotten about, and so I think it's probably one of the better films to come out this week on DVD Blu-ray.
Yeah, this is one. Honestly, like, I'm probably most interested in the De Osorio double feature, but Anime is one I've been meaning to see for ages. It's one I would definitely recommend.
Another one that will probably be recommended from Arrow Video this week. It's everybody's favorite, Reanimator.
And, this is one you don't even have to recommend.
Yeah, we can't even talk about Reanimator enough on this show.
No, it's like the greatest film ever.
it's the film that other films strive to be.
Actually, first of all, I totally agree with that. So, second of all, one of the films we'll be covering today, I actually compare very unfavorably to Reanimator, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah. And then finally, we got a 12 movie collection. It's Cinematic Titanic. This is the same group, Joel Hodgson, Trace Beaulieu, and company from MST3K. They created Cinematic Titanic and the aftermath of MST3K, and I believe this is all 12 movies that they've riffed on. I believe I read that correctly. And
yes, it's all 12 movies. I think it's like all public domain stuff.
Yeah. So. Did they riff on these live, and we got like a live track overlaying these movies? Like, is this like a live? You know what I mean? Like a live setting.
Oh, actually, let's ask. I've got Roxy here. Roxy, is Cinematic Titanic, was that live commentary or what?
They've done it. It was live commentary. I saw it live with live commentary, but they also released DVDs, which had pre-recorded commentary.
Yeah, because they've got like the set of the full movie of like all 12 movies they did.
I thought about John is getting Kelly that for a Christmas gift. I thought it's.
Yeah, so it is live commentary. I know, and I'm sure that was probably a less accessible format than Riff Tracks ended up being, because Riff Tracks is just incredibly convenient.
Yeah,
I think the DVDs had pre-recorded commentary.
Yeah, I mean this is the movies themselves. These releases are probably pre-recorded, but they did. I think this largely was a a traveling roadshow kind of deal.
Yeah, shout out to Roxy, our backstage historian. Thank you, Roxy.
Thank you, Roxy.
Welcome.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, Cinematic Titanic, I mean, you know, I actually kind of prefer, from what I've seen of it, kind of prefer it to Riff Tracks. I always thought the jokes in Riff Tracks got a little easy compared to their quality on MST.
Yeah. And like I was saying earlier, I'm not a huge fan of riffing, you know, over the movies, because I'm the kind of guy, I'm watching a movie, if it's a bad movie, I want to, those interruptions kind of take me out of, I might miss something in the dialogue.
Yeah, you know? I know exactly how you
Yeah,
feel.
And so I'd prefer to watch a movie, a bad movie, and, you know, riff on it myself, you know, and so the whole concept of MST3K and Riff Tracks and everything was kind of lost on me, and but I know it has a huge fan base, and it's referred to often. There's a lot of MST3K references and in other across the internet, you know, memes and whatnot. So it's definitely Cinematic Titanic is definitely in that vein, and it's probably for people who are fans of both Riff Tracks and MST3K.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I'm a fan of MST, but there are moments where I totally get what you're saying. The other day we were watching Teenagers from Outer Space, and I was surprisingly emotionally involved in that movie to the point where I was getting annoyed at the riffs because I really just wanted to experience the characters' like reactions to things.
Right, yeah. So yeah, so you get my point. So
yeah,
awesome. Okay, and that's pretty much your new releases for the week. There's some good ones out there and some not so good ones, and soon to be found in your Walmart discount bin alongside other Echo Bridge stuff. But some good stuff out there for sure. All right, so moving on to our topic of discussion this week, we're going to get into the master of the horror genre, I guess, since he's the most celebrated and probably the most read, Mr. Stephen King. And we're going to talk about movie adaptations of his work. But we're going to, you know, lay off the more well-known ones like Carrie and The Shining and, big ones like that. And we're going to get into maybe not necessarily the lesser-known stuff, but the lesser-celebrated stuff.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this will be this show will be put online after the weekend's over when we know the damage, how well or not so well the Dark Tower performs. Yeah. I'm guessing it's gonna be first at the box office this week, but kind of a week first.
Yeah,
because
I'm hearing, and this is, you know, the early based on early reviews, and I'm hearing the early reviews are not so good.
No, it seems like even before the reviews were coming in, all the hype was it was being reserved for the remake of it coming out this fall, and that's probably going to be the better film, honestly. I'm not terribly interested in it, but it's hard to deny the young cast they've assembled because they've got some good young actors for it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, in The Dark Tower, of course, with Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey. And, you know, the trailer for it, interesting to say the least, but, you know, my own opinion of it, it didn't really lend itself to... If you hadn't read the books, the Dark Tower series, then, you know, the trailer doesn't really give you any indication of what, you know, the epicness of the series overall. But yeah, you know, this seems like, and if the reviews and the returns that we're hearing are any indication, you know, this may be in danger of not seeing the complete run of the series, you know, on screen.
Yeah, and from what I understand, it's like, it's not even really the first Dark Tower book. This is going to spoil it for anyone who has read the series, but it basically ends in a time loop for the main character, where he gets a chance to go on his journey again and do it better. And this is basically after the time loop we know of in the seventh book.
Yeah.
So it's the first one, but explained to an audience who may have not read the books or even be familiar with them. But the Dark Tower itself, it doesn't seem to lend itself to a movie format, more of like a mini-series or an ongoing series format. Or honestly, a lot of them feel very difficult to film. I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff in those books, even more than a lot of other Stephen King adaptations. Yeah. So, like, and then they're connected to a million other Stephen King, like, books. I mean, they're deeply connected to Insomnia, to The Talisman, the fantasy book he wrote with Peter Straub, which had some sequels with that I never even got a chance to read. I mean, you know, they're connected to The Stand. Like, it basically requires a PhD in Stephen King to even understand, like, some of the later Dark Tower books.
Yeah, yeah. This isn't, you know, Stephen King, you know, he created whole worlds out of some of his works. Like, you've got the Castle Rock stuff. We won't get into a whole lot of Castle Rock stuff on this show, but and then there's the Dark Tower world, which connects to, you know, like you said, The Talisman. I read The Talisman. That's the only one of those books that I've read in that world. And I've read The Stand, and The Stand was an excellent read. I couldn't put it down. So, I mean, King has created whole universes out of this, and he's benefited from it very much so. And it's some of the stuff is really his more popular works.
Yes, definitely. And Stephen King loves to sort of do that interconnectedness. We're sort of going against that grain today, talking about the really singular stuff of his, the stuff that doesn't really link up to anything else.
No.
And, you know, a brief rant, because Lord knows I don't do that enough. The Crimson King shit from Insomnia and the Dark Tower, it's the King in Yellow, Stephen. Just use the... It's in the public domain. Everyone uses it. Just use the King in Yellow. As a fan of, like, pre-King horror, like, you know, that sort of turn-of-the-century era of horror, that really bothers me for some reason.
Yeah, I can see it does, Joe. I can see you... I can literally see you shaking on the other end here.
It's not really that bad, but it just... Seriously, if you're just going to rip off something that's already public domain, just use the public domain thing.
Yeah, that's right. No harm done. And that's what Echo Bridge does all the time.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get the ball rolling here, Joel. Which one should we start with? Or should we start with let's talk about Graveyard Shift. Let's start there.
Graveyard Shift, and which Graveyard Shift? Not a great movie for those of our listeners who haven't seen it. This is early '90s one, 1998 exactly, I believe. Based on a short story of his that was collected in Night Shift, a lot of these films we're going to be talking about are based on King short stories.
Yeah.
It takes place at a you know, crumbling old textile mill. They're cleaning it. They're cleaning out. There's to desperately try to keep it up to OSHA compliance. There's rats everywhere. You know, the main character is a drifter who's, you know, found work at this mill. There's a corrupt foreman who's kind of a real sadist, and he's, you know, sleeping around with women at the mill. But there's something more monstrous down, like, beneath the mill, which seems to be a giant bat. Not to spoil it for you, that seems anticlimactic to say. It's also weird because it's full of rats, and you expect something kind of rat-oriented.
Yeah, you expect a giant rat.
Yeah, you expect something like that. Or, honestly, the whole feel of it kind of reminds me a bit of, like, stories of ghouls, like the lurking Lovecraft stuff, like the lurking fear in Pickman's Model. Like, I expected ghouls, and you get a giant bat, which the effects in this one are actually pretty great. I mean, it's just, like, the effects and the set design, I mean, it's all just, it feels, you know, I was watching it with Roxy, and she said, this movie feels so sweaty.
Yeah.
And it is. It's like overwhelming heat everywhere, and there's just scraps of things everywhere. Scraps of cotton flying everywhere, scraps of, you know, fabric hanging from everything. Like, yeah.
It's really got that, you know, that grimy feel to it, you know?
It's totally grimy, and there's scraps of flesh coming off of people. It's a pretty gory film for what it is. It's not a great film, but the atmosphere is really convincing, and it does have a truly great performance in this one. Brad Dourif, who plays an exterminator, just named the Exterminator,
yeah,
who is a crazy Vietnam vet, but takes the time to tell us that he's not some crazy burning babies Vietnam vet that Bruce Dern's always playing, and those are his exact words.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Brad Dourif's amazing. This is some of the most intense acting he's ever done, and for him, that's saying a lot.
Yeah, Brad Dourif is quite awesome in most everything that he's in. And when we're talking about the guy who gave the voice to Chucky here, and he's Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, and I mean, and that's just to name a few. I remember way back when I first saw him in, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And just, you know, Brad Dourif is one of those underrated character actors. You call Brad Dourif and he's going to give you his all, no matter what role you give him.
Oh, yeah. And he's just phenomenal in this. And hilarious. I don't know how much of the dialogue, of his dialogue, was actually written as opposed to improvised. There's lines like, he's got an adorable little dog with him that he calls a rat terrier, and he brags that this dog didn't spend his... He didn't waste his puppy years catching frisbees on the beach with Frankie Annette.
Yeah, awesome dialogue from Brad there. Yeah, I like to think that he improvised his own stuff.
Because
if you listen to the rest of the movie, it just has that feel to it, you know?
Yeah, it's got a very... You know, a lot of the dialogue's pretty boilerplate. Like, you know, the characters are, you're pretty standard, like Stephen King. Like, if it's different from, like, Stephen King's stuff in any way, it's that the characters are a bit grimier, like they're sadder characters. Usually his big locations, like Derry and Castle Rock, they're kind of classic small towns. And this is taking place in the most, like, backwoods, dead main village ever. Like, it's only barely holding on due to the mill.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost a ghost town, basically.
And, yeah.
Unfortunately, Graveyard Shift doesn't work on the whole, but it's got some great, you know, aspects to it. Of course, the Dourif performance and the atmosphere and the set design and everything, and even the special effects, like you mentioned. So. It's definitely not one of the more notable King adaptations, but with that said, it definitely is, you know, worth a look as far as just a short little entertainment.
Yeah, it's just a good like late night monster movie. It's fun to watch.
You lower your expectations, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a totally, like, it's like worth, like, you know, the hour and a half of your time it's going to take.
Yeah. Well, I want to throw in Pet Sematary into this discussion.
We have things to talk about with Pet Sematary.
Yeah, this is a King adaptation, not partial. Now, I've read the book. I've read the book after I saw the film, of course. The movie. Now... Fred Gwynn is awesome, of course, and who else we got? Denise Crosby of Star Trek The Next Generation fame is in there. The lead actor, isn't Dale Midkiff?
Dale Midkiff, yeah.
Yes, that's his Dale Midkiff. Now, he's probably more bland than a sheet of paper in this film. that's part of the brilliance of this movie that I enjoy.
We have varying feelings about Pet Sematary here.
Well, I mean, of course, spoiler alert, their toddler dies by getting, you know, there's a highway in front of their house that they move into, and is constantly being traveled by big rig trucks, and they have a 2-year-old toddler named Gage who happens to wander out in the middle of the street and gets nailed by one of these big semis, brings the movie down for about 5 minutes. And then after that, the shit hits the fan, and this movie goes off the rails, and it does it in glorious fashion. I mean, just them bringing their pet cat to the cemetery and it coming back is nothing. I mean, the constant references to the cat being stinky are kind of funny. You know, when his young daughter calls up on the phone and asks how her kitty's doing, and the dad lies about it, of course, and... you know, once Gage gets creamed by a big rig, you know, Dad has the right idea to bury the kid in this old Indian, this pet cemetery on, you know, ancient Indian burial grounds, and we have evil Gage. The scene where he chases down Fred Gwynn is awesome. Just Fred Gwynn being chased through his house by a 2-year-old dimmy toddler.
You know, I hate that kid.
Yeah, and just everything just goes to shit after that kid dies. And I have watched it, and I had one big goofy grin on my face, almost from beginning to end in that film, but especially the last 30 minutes of that film. And then, of course, Denise Crosby. I'm giving the whole movie away here because this is Pet Sematary. It's from 1989. If you haven't seen it, you're never going to see it. You know, Denise Crosby gets killed, and good old Dale wants to bring her back. And she's only been dead for a few hours, but she comes back with rotting flesh for some reason. I don't get that. And he makes out with her. Plain as I'm just going to go for it. He's into her. And if that's your thing, fly your flag, baby, you know? It was awesome.
Oh, my God. All right, so here's the thing for me with Pet Sematary. First of all, credit to South Park, which is not always my favorite show, but, my God, their parody of Fred Gwynn in this was phenomenal. And Fred Gwynn is awesome in the movie. I mean...
Yeah.
Every note he hits is so perfect. He, you know, exactly. When he's funny, he's funny. When he's warm, he's like the friendliest guy in the world. When he's heartfelt, and even like really that scene where he's blaming himself for Gage's death, because he feels like he's led the family astray.
He's the one that told Dale Midkiff about the burial ground. You know, so he feels responsible for that.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's so heart-wrenching. He's so good in everything. See, here's the thing for me of the film is that the tone is so all over the place. Like, everything up until Gage dying, like, it's so well done. Like, it's a slow burn film. It's gradually increasing in intensity. Partly because, like, there's trucks constantly going by. It's always a reminder that that this place is dangerous and someone's going to die. Like, you know, it's just – it's phenomenally tense in a very, like, understated way at the same time. It's just a really good film. But when Gage dies, it turns into total narm. Like, the scene where he dies, it's, first of all, kind of a ripoff of the Mad Max's wife and son.
Yeah, the shoe flying off, and yeah, exactly.
That's a total ripoff, and it's just like there's of course a slow motion big no, which is always cheesy. Then there's the fight at the funeral where Dale Midkiff's father-in-law, who's always hated him anyway, gets furious at him and starts like attacking it, knocks the coffin over.
He knocks the coffin, the kid falls out.
Yeah,
oh, like, I forgot about that. That was hilarious.
And here's the interesting thing to me is that when I read the book, it was probably around fifth, sixth grade, before I had any significant deaths in my family. So it didn't really affect, like, I thought it was an interesting book. It didn't really affect me terribly, but I remember reading it I was reading at a family function because, God, those are boring. And if people, like, adults saying, oh, I couldn't watch the movie, all the stuff with the child dying. Like, it's very much like a movie about adult fears. And the stuff I'm singling out as totally cheesy is probably something that, like, an actual parent would find absolutely horrifying, but to me, because they don't have that the same kind of, detachment I do. Yeah. So,
well, Joel, I'm a guy who cheered the death of Macaulay Culkin at the end of The Good Son, like we mentioned last week.
Well, so he was a dick.
You know where my stance is on you know where my stance is on kid deaths and
well, things. It's like Rhoda dying in the bad seat. They deserve it. It's not like Alex Kittner in Jaws, where he's just like a normal kid. Like those kids are sociopaths. They deserve what they get. But
yeah.
But no, it's a film that, like, and of course it totally does go off the rails after that. Like, everything is cheesy. Like, the kid running around, like, goofily, like, you know. So, and I'm not even really sure, like, the nature of what's going on in the movie, because it seems like the dead can, like, make illusions, and then there's that subplot, which actually works really well, where someone gets hit by a truck early in the film, and Dale Midkiff is unable to save him. He's a doctor in this. But the ghost follows them around trying to help the family, trying to steer them away from the burial ground.
Oh, yeah, the guy with half his head missing, that's right.
Yeah, massive head wound Harry there. No, and it's a great visual because he's just dressed in, like, a hoodie and a shirt and shorts. He's just, like, a normal dude who's probably out for a run. Like, and the performance is really interesting, just a bit off kilter. Not, like, he's creepy enough to be creepy, but he's obviously really trying to help them. Like, it's a great tone. And that's what I'm saying, like, some of the stuff, because tone is so all over the place, the more adaptable actors are really, like, making it work, like this guy does, Fred Gwynne does. I mean, it's so weird that, like, a film that's very serious and often very maudlin has a Ramones soundtrack.
All right, yeah. Of course, the song is titled Pet Cemetery, so that's what you're going to get with the Ramones.
Well, and even in the middle of the film, the truck driver who ends up, you know, splatting Gage on the highway is listening to Sheena as a punk rocker, which apparently is that the number one cause of, like, children getting hit by semi trucks? Is it, like, people too invested in singing along with the Ramones?
Singing too much Ramones will kill children.
Another point.
Somewhere in the world, someone is singing a Ramones song, and in another part of the world, a child is dying.
Oh, the Ramones, what can't you do?
So, I mean, the whole scene with Head Wound Harry there talking to Denise Crosby, trying to reach out to her, trying to get her to realize that Dale Midkiff is making a bad choice. You know, that whole thing is just hilarious. You're right about the shift in tone. I mean, it starts off as a totally fine, you know, family. I'm not going to say a family film, but a very good setup to stuff that's about to come. And then when that stuff comes, the tone shifts completely to just insane, off the wall. You know, you can even say comedy, because this stuff is so outlandish that they just had to be laughing at it when they were filming it.
Yeah, it's hard to really. It's weird because so much of the film is somber. I mean, it's an atmosphere of death everywhere. Like, you know, there's a woman who a local woman who helps them out with, like, just household stuff, who kills herself in a very difficult to watch scene. Just hangs herself. It's very harsh because she's dying of cancer. It's, yeah, it's clear, like, she's kind of got it's pretty clear over the course of the film she's got some kind of internal, probably stomach cancer. Like, there's just this atmosphere of pervasive death throughout it, and it's so somber and so solemn. I mean, there's that weird backstory that Denise Crosby gets, where she was taking care of her sister.
Her sister And her the memories of her sister keep, and her sister was creepy looking, man, because she was so sick.
Her sister had spinal meningitis, but the makeup is all weird. It's like the makeup is like zombie ghoul makeup. I've never seen anyone with actual spinal meningitis, but I'm guessing it's not like it's depicted in the film, because she looks like she should be on The Walking Dead. It's just strange, and it doesn't really have much.
It doesn't have any bearing on the story, you know, being told whatsoever. It's just, like you said, that there is a something about adult fears in this film, but really, in terms of the story going on at hand, it doesn't really relate.
Yeah, no, I think it's just like this compilation of fears parents have, really. You know, there's something vaguely interesting about, like, about their daughter's reactions to things. Like, a lot of it is about her. This doesn't really get paid off, though, because she's just kind of left in Chicago with the grandparents for the end of, the big plot at the end. Yeah. Like, but a lot of it seems to be about her coming into contact with death for the first time. Like, there's a lot about, like, you know, Fred Gwynn, like, brings them to have Dale Midkiff to have the cat revived in the burial ground, because he doesn't think this girl is ready for her favorite pet to die. And, you know, a cat coming back weird is obviously a lot less dangerous than, like, a person coming back weird. Quite frankly, there's a lot of inconsistency in how people and animals come back, because the cat was bad-tempered but didn't really seem, like, particularly dangerous, whereas, like, Gage comes back and suddenly setting traps for people, like... like he's Michael Myers or Chucky. And, you know, Fred Gwynn tells the story about a grieving father who, you know, brought his son back, a son who had died in World War II, and it's more like Bob Clark's death dream. The son is just kind of a vacant ghoul.
Yes, exactly. And I honestly think that may have been a little ode to death dream there.
Probably,
yeah, good point on bringing that up, but... I mean, we could go on and on about Pet Cemetery, right? You know? I mean, I love it. You sound like you want to love it, but you're kind of hesitant.
I love elements of it. I love Fred Gwynn's performance, obviously. I love everything the Ramones do, regardless of context. There's things about Pet Cemetery I find really interesting, and I think it doesn't, like, actually follow through on most of them.
Yeah, and of course, just enjoying how much of a good time I was having watching that movie.
Yeah.
I reviewed that for the website, Joel. I gave it 3 stars out of 5, and that's a passing grade for me. I couldn't go. Of course, I can't in good conscience go much higher than that. But I do recommend Pet Cemetery if you want to see a movie that just goes batshit crazy off the rails in the last third of it or so.
It does go batshit crazy off the rails. You know, and I think partly I was going in with those memories of, like, you know, older people in my family, like, really horrified by this movie because, like, you know, it's every fear they've ever had as parents. Like, that was the movie I was really more expecting to see. And there definitely is that element there, but there's also so much weirdness that it just completely threw me off from what I was expecting this to be.
Yeah. All right. So, we agree on certain points of this film, and of course, we all know how I feel about it, so that's all that matters. So, we still have more in this vein, though, Joel. What else we got here?
We've talked about confusion in tone. We have an absolute bottom of the barrel Stephen King film, and a brief interlude. Stephen King, of course, writes a lot of different kinds of stories, but there's a couple things you can always count on coming back in a lot of his stories. There are curses, and there are possessed or otherwise active inanimate objects. It's something he comes back to again and again, and when those things come up, it's usually, like, bottom of the barrel Stephen King. Like, I needed Coke money, like 70s and 80s Stephen King.
Yes, sir.
And I don't think that's unfair to say he's pretty open about his cocaine addiction. I mean, it did end in him dating Yardley Smith. She's offense to Miss Lisa Simpson there, but a guy that rich and famous could have been dating, like, I'm just saying Billy Joel did, like, Christie Brinkley, and he's Billy Joel. He sucks.
Yeah, that was a Hollywood A-list couple there, Stephen King and Yardley Smith.
Weirdly enough, yeah.
What would they call them? Yard King or... Kingly?
I feel like Kingly is the nicer
Kingly,
one.
Kingly? Steve-ly?
Oh, my God. So Bomb of the Barrel Stephen King is usually curse or inanimate object, and sometimes he'll come up with the dumbest inanimate object to use, which brings us to the Mangler.
Oh, the Mangler, dude. Yeah, I love the Mangler.
I love it too, and I gotta say, I think a lot of people are wrong about the Mangler. Having just seen it for the first time, and it's a Tobe Hooper film, and obviously it's not one of his, like, best regarded. But knowing Tobe's work like I do, and of course Robert Englund's there, and we'll get to the specifics of his performance in a bit, but knowing Robert, there's no way that this film was not a black comedy in their mind, even if a lot of people probably didn't take it that way.
Oh, well, I mean, come on. I mean, what's the object du jour in this film? It's an evil laundry press.
Well, I mean, you know, it's got all those gears, and it crushes things, and it's just the worst idea.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Stephen King was probably getting some pants pressed at the... damn it, Joel, what the hell are those places called?
Laundromat? Dry cleaner?
The dry cleaners. Holy shit. Why couldn't I think of that?
The Mangler just took over. You can't think of anything else but the Mangler.
Oh, my gosh. So when I'm thinking about the Mangler, and I totally forget my vocabulary.
Actually, the funny thing is, I looked into this, and... one of his early jobs before he was a successful author was working in an industrial laundry. Yeah. So he probably did operate a mangle or a laundry press or whatever you want to call it.
So he's like probably back there pressing pants, and he's like, wouldn't it be cool if one of these things came alive and started killing people?
Quite frankly, that's like barely a good concept for a short story. I can't believe they got three films out of this goddamn thing.
Yeah, and so... the reviews for this thing weren't kind, of course, when they came out. I mean, Tobe Hooper, this is the guy who directed, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So he's made his mark in not just horror film history, but cinematic history. Because Chainsaw is one of the all-time great films, no matter what genre. But
well-regarded.
There was at least one, you know, critic calling for Tobe Hooper to hang it up after this thing was released.
Yeah, I really don't think people understood this quite as well. And I'm not saying this was too deep for them or anything. I just, based on the tone of it and how consistent the strangeness and, like, the asinine qualities of this are, and just knowing Toby's stuff, knowing Robert Englund's stuff, and of course, it just, the interactions between, of course, Ted Levine is the main character. He's a police, you know, very downbeat, like, dead-end police officer here, and he's awesome. Zach Levine is always awesome. And, you know, he's hanging out with his magic-obsessed, aging hippie former brother-in-law. He's a widower. Ted Levine's a widower in this. And just their interactions, like, it became clear they interact like an old married couple, and the way they talk about, like, these magical concepts with each other. I mean, to give people an indication, not just the... laundry press is in this. It definitely, and it is not haunted, it is demonically possessed. That's an important distinction to make. But there also seems to be a possessed old icebox in here. and they talk about into the laundry press. So evil transferred from the icebox to the laundry press.
I was going to say the Mangler had a like a comic book style origin there, because it started with the girl in the film getting cut and her blood dripping onto the laundry press, and then the icebox falling on top of it. So the icebox and the blood combined into one and created the evil possessed Mangler.
Oh, but there's a third element, which is to the ritual, which is antacids into the Mangler, which contain extracts of nightshade.
Nightshade, blood, and old iceboxes create evil demonic possessions.
Which it could happen to anybody. I mean, it's just this is commonplace in our world today. But no, you can't tell me that they were serious about these concepts. Knowing these creators, it seems impossible that they weren't laughing about this. Exactly. And that's before we even get into Robert Englund's character, who is the factory owner, who was walking around in leg braces with like a tracheotomy tube in his throat, like these weird glasses because one eye seems occluded by cataracts or whatever. I don't know. And he's still somehow taking advantage of one of his employees who he implies used to be a prostitute. It's not like Graveyard Shift where the corrupt factory foreman was a fairly realistic one, just one with anger issues, and who does kind of go nuts by the end of the film, but the circumstances are probably extenuating there. Like, Robert Englund seems to be playing some kind of Dr. Strangelove-ish character. It's like half Dr. Strangelove, half like old Peter Lorre, Mad Love style villain.
Yeah, it's like, so he has, I'd like to be in on the meeting of how he developed that character, because
I know.
I mean, he's like, yeah, my character is going to need leg braces, and let me put some sunglasses on here, and it's just the costuming pretty much made the character in this case. So of course Robert Englund, he there's not a whole lot wrong he can do. In this genre, in this type of film. But yeah, I'm pretty sure if we asked him, he'd probably tell us that he totally came up with all of those ideas for himself.
Oh yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet, but there's a video of him at a con talking about his experience working with Tobe Hooper that I really need to watch, because I'm curious what the actual process of making the Mangler, what the creative process was like to work on this film together.
Lots of booze, lots of drugs. That's probably about it.
For the Mangler.
Yeah. And that's a great addition to this conversation, of course, is the Mangler, Joel.
Like I said, now, not all of these films we're talking about are bottom of the barrel Stephen King, but bottom of the barrel Stephen King is a very specific bottom of the barrel. And it's also like the way people sometimes on TV shows, you'll see like brief Twilight Zone parodies that focus on like the twist endings, like, it was me along, or I was Hitler and didn't know it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Twilight Zone, I think, was always fairly high quality. Like, that's more riffing on some of the more famous moments rather than some of the cliches of the Twilight Zone. But with Stephen King, when you get into the bottom of the barrel, like, you can tell what his habits are. I mean, there's always it's always like a worse version of his better traditional horror stuff anyway, because there's always some kind of corruption involved, something about small town's falling apart.
Yeah.
But it's always the most mundane idea that he's trying to just like desperately squeeze into a workable horror concept.
Right, exactly. You know, there's, I think that's one of the things in a lot of his works is a lot of his stories have this, they take place in, you know, small, nondescript towns that usually contain a secret of some kind. And I think in a lot of these cases, well, I guess the Mangler aside, you know, Graveyard Shift and, you know, Pet Cemetery, you know, they took place in kind of rural settings. I mean, Graveyard Shift was out in the, it was the mill out in the sticks, but I mean, the place was almost a ghost town. And well, of course, Pet Cemetery takes place out in the sticks as well. And, you know, it's just, but that's prevalent throughout a lot of his, even his more well-known works. You know, when you've got like a, something like Salem's Lot or the stories that take place in Castle Rock or Derry, just a small town feel to it. And there's always a secret that's being hidden, you know, by someone or something.
Here's the big secret of the Mangler for me. It's supposed to be Maine, yet it looks like it's like on a haunted bayou.
I don't know of any bayous in Maine. It's supposed to take place in Maine, but I guess the cost of filming in Maine was a little too expensive, so they decided to take it to the swamps of Louisiana or something.
I really need to look up where that thing was filmed, because it that was not Maine.
No, certainly not. Maine is a lot of rocks and water. So, yeah. So I think, the Mangler is a good one. And I think one I want to throw in here, Joel, onto this next one here real quick, is actually this is, I think, one of his stories he wrote under his pseudonym, Robert Bachman. We're talking about Thinner. I think later on, when it was revealed that Bachman was his pseudonym, it was, you know, re-released as Stephen King's Thinner, both the novel and the film itself. And basically, you're talking about curses. This is the story of a gypsy curse placed on a man who runs afoul of an old gypsy. I think he kills. In a car accident, he kills a gypsy and the mother or wife or something. I can't remember exactly 100% certain, but she places a curse on the man. And he, of course, he's a robust dude. And very quickly throughout the story, he's losing weight until he's pretty gaunt looking near the end. And when you mentioned Bottom of the Barrel King, this is close. This is close to Bottom of the Barrel in terms of where it is in his actual written works and where it is in film adaptations, really.
Yeah, and you're correct. This was, I think, the last Richard Bachman novel before. He did some in the 90s, I think, after people knew it was a pseudonym, but this was the last one before he was, the pseudonym was outed.
Yeah.
You know, this is one I actually. The backstory is more interesting than the actual book, because it was actually about his own weight problems.
Right, yes, that's correct, yeah.
But, no, I've both read the book and seen the movie, and to this day I wonder why. Because there's just, it's another one of those things where I can't believe he got a novel of it, because it's so thin. And God damn it, that I did not mean to make that pun.
I was about to call you out on it.
No, it's just there's so little there. Like aside from maybe like the twist ending, and there's some weird pointless detours with him, like, you know, the lawyer. Lead representing mobsters, yeah. And I think at some point he attacks the gypsy camp. Like,
yeah, this is not much to be said about this movie. It's really, really also a nondescript film. There's nothing really overly bad about it. It's just very for a King film. There's very, I think, bland storytelling. Very cookie cutter as well.
It feels very much like kind of a waste of time.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
Yeah, which is weird when you be, and I say that mostly because the director of the film was Tom Holland, who did Child's Play and Fright Night, and this was not his first Stephen King. He also did The Langoliers, but you know he wrote Beast Within and Class of 1984 and Psycho 2. I mean, most people listening to us are probably reasonably familiar with his work.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the very least, Child's Play and Fright Night, which are, you know, modern horror classics. The Langoliers was also bad, don't get me wrong, but it was bad in kind of an interesting way, partly because, like, the actual design of the monsters and the effects used for them were so terrible, and it's like sort of a marvel of overacting, of like TV actors trying to be dramatic.
Bronson Pinchot. I loved him in Beverly Hills Cop, and that's probably about it.
Yeah, now, and there are good actors in this. I mean, David Morse and Dean Stockwell are in there, yeah. But like, you know, when you get Bronson Pinchot screaming, "Scaring the little girl."
Yeah, and you mentioned the monster, and they look like just like distorted Pac-Man, just chewing everything up.
They're just really terrible designs, and I don't know if it's maybe just the effects to do that kind of because there's an old horror story that I think it's very much inspired by, the Hounds of Tindalos, basically creatures outside of what we consider our time and our universe that basically eat away at time. And, you know, that's an abstract concept to get across, but the Langoliers did not do it well. I think they're going for like a multidimensional, like elusive, weird look, and they just kind of got formless, blobby.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, we're getting off track. Let's get back to Thinner, I guess.
Yeah, see, that's what Thinner does to you. It makes you want to talk about other things. And that's a good idea, Joel. Thinner's not, and that's how nondescript it is, really. It's not an overly bad film, but nothing really stands out about it that's really worth talking about. But we threw it in the conversation because it's really one of King's stranger one-off works that, you know, just deserves mention just for the sake of it, I guess.
But, you know, the King was still doing Gypsy Curses in, you know, I don't remember when the book came out. I would say late 70s if it was a Richard Bachman novel. But he was still doing Gypsy Curses in that era. It's obviously, like, not high-quality Stephen King. Weirdly enough, the movie got screened alongside Michael Jackson's Ghosts in a lot of theaters. Like, they bundled them together for some reason.
Yeah, that's weird, huh?
I don't know why that was. It might just be, it's a horror story. Ghosts was co-written by King, I think. Which is, weird enough. Don't even know what to say about that.
I think we've gone ahead and given Thinner too much time that it really didn't deserve.
More time than anyone else is given there, and that includes Stephen King and Tom Holland.
People are going to be listening to this and be like, "What? Why are they talking about Thinner and they're not really saying anything about it?"
But all we can talk about is how little there is to talk about. But briefly on Thinner, let's just spoil it for people. I really want to. So there is a cursed pie in Thinner,
yes.
And this is probably the third most notable pie scene in a film I can think of. There's probably like pie fights in other films. Let's leave out pie fights,
yeah.
Because that's a whole other, because there's a million Three Stooges shorts, and there's the lost ending to Dr. Strangelove, and a million other things with pies. Number one would, of course, be, you know, the pie fucking American Pie.
Oh, yeah.
Number two would be Rooney Mara Humphrey eating that pie for 5 minutes and a ghost story.
That's right.
Yeah. Like, 5 minute pie eating is pretty great. Number three is Thinner, in which as a to that Thinner condition, just wasting away, not being able to absorb nutrients, basically, until you die, that he gives his cheating wife. But then in the morning, he finds out his daughter is also eating a piece of pie.
and so there you go. That's why we talk about thinner, because it's the number three pie-eating scene on Joel's list. Very short list.
Actually, I'm sorry, it's number four, because there was the pie-eating contest in Stand By Me.
It's been bumped already.
It's been bumped.
Oh, then. Yeah, if it's not top three, then there's no sense in going on about it, then.
Now, let's move on. You disgust me, thinner.
Yeah, I think that's a good cause for a break here, Joel, as you said, thinner has just drained us. So let's hit up the promo, and when we come back on the other side, we'll get into some of King's anthology stuff. Plenty to talk about there, so stay with us and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA on-demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. You lucked into a good show this week. We're talking Stephen King adaptations on the big screen. Some are on a small screen, but mainly big screen. And we talked about some of his one-off stories, like The Mangler and... I've already forgotten about Thinner. And you know, Graveyard Shift, Pet Sematary.
Well, could add more words to the Thinner discussion.
Oh, my goodness. I think we've devoted too many words to Thinner as it is.
Just a desperate attempt to try to justify the time spent watching and reading it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go a little on the deeper side here. We're going to get into his anthology stories that made it to the big screen. Creepshow, Creepshow 2, some Quicksilver Highway, maybe some Cat's Eye even, Joe, if we have time for it. But let's kick it off with, you know, the best-known Creepshow. And I have a copy of Creepshow on VHS. I'm lucky enough for that. And my favorite story, of course, from the first Creepshow is The Crate with Hal Holbrook and Adrian Barbeau. I think it's just an excellent story. I think the works here in Creepshow are probably some of King's, you know, finer, you know, works for the big screen as it is. And I think, you know, the Crate pretty much sums up the Creepshow and the anthology film concept in a nutshell.
Yeah, you know, of course, this is the most well-known and well-loved of the films we're talking about today. The Crate is an interesting case because it's based on King's own stories, but it's very, I would almost say, simpler in concept than a lot of his work, and because he likes very concept stories, but you know, a lot of high concepts, a lot of weirder ideas, I guess. I mean, that sounds vague, but I mean, when you look at like what the actual plot of, say, It is, or The Dark Tower, like, they're framed on simpler, understandable, like, narratives. I mean, Dark Tower is basically a Western. It, you know, is centered around the killer clown childhood fear idea, but the actual happenings, the mechanics of it, are so, like, elaborate and convoluted. The Crate is interesting because it's such a simple idea, and it's also so, it fits in so well with an EC comic style like Creepshow is, that it's hard to believe this isn't one of the ones he wrote for the movie itself.
Yeah, and I agree with that. This is the type of story that you would find, you know, DC and Marvel and others, you know, that had the horror concept, you know, especially prevalent throughout the 70s. And this is a story that could have easily have been found in one of those actual comics, like House of Mystery, House of Horrors, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, this could have been a Tales from the Crypt or Vault of Horror comic from EC, like,
yeah, and basically, Hal Holbrook is married to Adrian Barbeau, and Adrian Barbeau cuckolds him constantly, and he's easily cuckolded. And she berates him and mocks him and insults him, and she's constantly drunk. And he discovers within the confines of the university, he discovers a crate from parts unknown, I believe. My recollection is a little shoddy on that, but
I think it was from an Arctic expedition,
yes.
like 100 years before, or so that was in the was in like their biology department. It was just like, or zoology maybe. It was just within the college's, you know, a large supply of scientific finds that they had never really looked into.
Yeah, and so once our old friend Hal realizes what's in the crate, he concocts a plan to rid himself of his evil drunk bitch of a wife, and that devises the climax of the story. I think it's just a very well done, well crafted story. I mean, given the short confines of a short film in an anthology series, it's very well crafted with a great setup and good pacing throughout. And just the payoff was an excellent payoff.
Yeah, it's just a classic, like a karmic punishment kind of shock horror horror narrative, like we said, like the kind you'd find in old horror comics. The Kray I really enjoy, and of course it's got a great monster. It's a very cool story, but my favorite is the one I'm always surprised that this is my favorite. It's The Lonesome Death of Geordi Verrill.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is based on another pre-existing King story, Weeds. And that kind of shows because it's very much its own thing. I mean, it's a comic story with a really tragic ending. It's very much, a direct lift in concept of The Color Out of Space from H.P. Lovecraft. Geordi Verrill, who's played by Stephen King, finds a meteorite that he wants to sell to the local college to pay, because he needs the money. But the meteorite spreads this plant, this moss kind of organism that starts growing over him, growing over everything. Yeah. But the interesting thing, he's playing a complete yokel, complete backwoods. I mean, a total caricature of like a backwoods hillbilly, and yet King is not like, there's a lot of acting talent in this. He's not in this film. He's not Hal Holbrook. He's not Leslie Nielsen. He's not Adrian Barbeau. But yet he manages to create. It must just be Romero working with him so well, like, manages to create a really endearing character who's just, despite the fact that he's such an artificial construct of a character, you understand his, he's basically alone. He sees the ghost of his dad who's telling him what not to do, which, of course, he doesn't listen to because the thing is, don't get water on it, which, of course, he's, trying to wash this thing off, and it just grows and grows. And, there's just something really endearing and sad about this character. He's totally alone. He's too dumb to understand what's happening to him, and quite frankly, even a more intelligent character probably wouldn't understand. This weird find just seems to be his, his ticket to at least some sort of measure of financial, relief.
He thinks he's going to get rich with this thing.
There's this amazing daydream moment. Like, at first he daydreams that the college is going to buy it and, thank him and think he's great for finding it. Then it breaks in half, which is how the green mossy substance, breaks out of it. And he's so horrified they broke this thing. He thinks that the college that he imagines, by the way, that the college has a meteor department, is going to shun him and talk down to him, and they're not going to accept a broken meteor. But he's so disconnected from reality and so childlike. It's and such an innocent. It's just an oddly affecting performance in a way I really didn't expect to be moved by this.
It definitely is one of the more underrated performances in the entire film, and it was just surprising because it's Stephen King. He's better known as an author than he is an actor, and Geordi Verrill, the character, is just a quite simple man, and like you said, lonely. And I think really King probably just channeled a lot of stuff into that from his own personal life, because he's got a dark history himself with bouts of depression and whatnot. So it's just really just King really surprisingly pays off in this segment.
Yeah, I also think it's almost like a role that worked out better with an amateur actor than it did would have with a lot of experienced professionals, because he manages to approach this in such a weird childlike way. I mean, there's very few actors who I think could have pulled that off well.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the most memorable line from him in the movie is when he discovers it and he's like, he calls it meteor shit. My brother and I are big fans of this movie, and every now and then when we talk to each other, we'll call some unknown substance that we're talking about, we'll just call it meteor shit. so that stuck with me for quite a long time. So but yeah this is uh one of the more underappreciated segments of the original Creepshow.
I think so. You know, I think, like, The Crate gets a lot of press. I think Father's Day gets a lot of press because it's got a classic story. And that was written for the film, so I think King was probably doing that in an EC, like, style, like a classic karmic horror story style, because it has that kind of ending to it.
Yeah.
And it's got the real, like, you know, the rich, selfish, like, socialite family, which is a classic of this kind of story.
Yeah, and one of the things about this, the Leslie Nielsen Ted Danson segment, you're so used to seeing Leslie Nielsen do these parody films from the 90s, like Naked Gun and Spy Hard and Dracula, Dead and Loving It, and, you know, stuff that you know, you see him in a segment where he's actually playing a dick. You kind of forget that Leslie Nielsen actually is a qualified, you know, actor, and because he played the dick very well.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, he can, when Leslie wants to be, because he's always very go for broke in his comic performances. I mean, when he wants to be like a vicious character, that like that energy comes out in him, and there's a sort of glee in him that he gets to finally put one over on. You know, his wife and, you know, the man who his wife is cheating on him with. Like there's a real, like, Bond villain glee to him when he's explaining what's going to happen.
Yes, yes. So, you know, probably one of my more favorite Leslie Nielsen moments is in this film. And, of course, Don't Call Me Shirley in Airplane as well. you know, regardless of that, the first Creepshow, quite a memorable film in terms of anthology films. I think it's probably, in my estimation, probably the standard bearer of anthology films.
Oh, easily.
Easily. And, because it's just one memorable short film after another in this one. Which leads us into Creepshow 2. Not as good, but it still has some memorable segments in it. Of course, my favorite one from Creepshow 2 is The Raft.
Yeah.
It's just the one that stuck with me the most from this one.
Yeah. Now, Creepshow 2 has a bit of an interesting history behind it, that a couple of the stories that were planned, they were going to do five, like the original Creepshow. A couple of the stories that were planned were scrapped to reduce the budget. And one of them, Cat from Hell, was filmed for Tales from the Dark Side, the movie.
Yeah, okay.
So,
which came out on DVD just last week.
Yep. And that one, a lot of people consider Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, the real Creepshow 3, because obviously there was the one that got released, what was it, about 10 years back or so?
Yeah.
That didn't have really any connection to the EC Comics or to King or Romero. I mean, just it's been forgotten, I'd imagine. But yeah, Creepshow 2 is not the film Creepshow 1 could have been, or was. It was, you know, could have been that level maybe, but you know, it's still a decent anthology film. And you know, special mention goes to The Raft, which, you know, as a kid was probably my favorite Stephen King short story, and is done so well here.
Yes, it is.
And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. For those unfamiliar, it's a group of four college kids who go to this world lake, they go swimming, and there's sort of a floating blob that starts consuming them one by one in the motor.
Yeah, it kind of looks like an oil slick on the water.
It very much seems like a commentary on, I mean, it's an obvious environmental commentary. You know, I don't know when the Exxon Valdez crash happened, although I imagine that was after King wrote The Raft, but it feels very much like in the world where oil is an environmental hazard.
Yeah.
So, but Yeah, and it's very much a blob style story, but it's also incredibly grotesque. I mean,
it's corrosive. It's just melts their skin.
Yeah, people get consumed in the most horrific ways. There's one character who gets pulled through the raft, basically.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, basically, you know, you remember that scene in Friday the 13th Part 6 with the sheriff getting bent backwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of resembles that. The guy gets pulled through the raft and his legs end up over his head. And quite grotesque.
It's a gruesome scene. I mean, and, you know, this is one of the King adaptations that's probably, like, closest to the actual story. Because it's so there's even that weird moment where, you know, a couple of them are left on the raft. One of the boys and one of the girls, and the boy is fondling the girl while she's asleep. And it's just like, it's a weird moment because it doesn't seem connected to the rest of it, but the whole thing seems to be kind of, there's sort of a sub narrative about how much of a weakling and how pathetic this particular guy is.
Right, yes.
Like, he's not as strong as his friend. He's not, you know, he's not as athletic. He's not as forthright. And it, you know, I think it's almost like just trying to consciously subvert that kind of classic monster movie narrative. Like, there's no big heroic moment for him. He, you know, takes advantage of this, like, exhausted, pretty much in shock girl, which, you know, leads to her death, which he uses to try to escape, and he nearly does. Now I'm spoiling it for everyone, but he reaches the shore, and he's, like, triumphant. He's, like, taunting the thing. I beat you! And then the blob rears up like a wave and, like, just falls on him. And then the last thing you see is it going back out into the lake with, like, you know, his, like, a big bulge where he would be.
Actually, I actually cheered for the blob in that scene.
Oh, yeah, no, like, he's a rapist, basically.
Yeah, he's a creepy little dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another story in this that I kind of liked, I kind of enjoyed the outcome because, you know, the segment with the cigar store Indian.
Old Chief Woodenhead.
Yeah, Old Chief Woodenhead, George Kennedy in this, of course. I like George Kennedy. I like George.
Oh, George is great.
Yeah, and very sympathetic character. Just basically an old man and running an old general store in a desert town, and him and his wife get killed by some punks, and it was kind of, you know, kind of sad, you know, because, you know, they're old people. They didn't hurt anybody, and of course, Old Chief Woodenhead takes action and gets his revenge. Probably very slowly, I reckon. But that was like a satisfying story, I believe.
There's some interesting stuff in that one too, because they're this old guy. It's George Kennedy and Dorothy Lamour, who a lot of people probably know best for doing the a lot of the road comedies with Hope and Crosby. And I think this was her last role. And they're like a sweet old married couple, and they're friends with, you know, they're basically like the last gasp of any business around here. It's a very much a tribal area. Like, they're friends with one of the elders of the tribe, who's Frank Salcido, who played an older Native American actor who played in a million roles as, like, you know, the on TV and film as, like, you know, your token Indian character. And the lead punk is his I forget if it was his grandson, I believe, who is obsessed with, who is kind of a fascinatingly vain character. He's obsessed with his own looks, his own long hair. He's trying to earn money so he can go out to Hollywood. He wants to be an actor, which
he
of course
his beautiful head of hair was going to get him some dough in Hollywood,
which of course leads to what you'd expect, where Old Chief Woodenhead helps him. I'm curious how people would respond to this segment, because it's a really interesting segment, because it's not just, you know, you get those moments where It's really trying to portray this dead town and the reservation around it. It's really trying to give you a sense of what life's like here, which feel fairly accurate. Like, it feels like it's attaining some kind of veracity in terms of what, like, a dead area with nothing but, like, a tribal reservation that's sort of waning to begin with would be like. But at the same time, like, the actual overtones are so racially charged and racially tinged. I mean, you credit that they're actually using Native American actors, by the way. It's not like, you know, Italians pretend, or like Mexican actors pretending to be Native Americans.
Yes, that's correct. You know, that's something I don't recall back in the time surrounding this film, if there was much focus on, you know, things like that, as there are now, of course. But, definitely, you know, probably ahead of its time in that case, using actual Native American actors, which is something that they would probably do now anyway. But back then it wasn't as common, because, like you said, they would use actors of other nationalities or races to do that.
Yeah, just dudes who were at least relatively, like, darker skinned and just kind of pretend. Yeah. Or worse, I mean, yeah, not so much in the late 80s, obviously, but, you know, going back to the westerns of the 40s and 50s.
Oh, yeah, you would have, sometimes you would have guys in grease paint.
Yeah.
You know, it's black and white, you can't really tell, but it's obviously a dark-skinned individual, but it looks fake.
Yeah.
You know, so it's actually, and that was actually quite common back then. It's just, let's put some grease paint on them and, you know, pose them as Mexican or Native American or whatever the case is.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's an interesting story. Because I'm not really sure if they were really thinking about undertones, of course. But it's like, you know, you've got like the cigar store Indian doing this, and when you think of a cigar store Indian, it's like, you know, now it's not quite like having, you know, there's a lot of racist art in the past used as advertising features. I mean,
yeah.
Generally speaking, a lot of the ones using Native American images are at least physically less offensive than a lot of the ones using images of African American people. Like, yeah. The actual physical features aren't as exaggerated, but it's still obviously a racially charged image, you like a cigar store Indian. So
yeah, and I was going to say the cigar store Indian, of course, comes into play in that one episode of Seinfeld, which is actually has a racist subtext to it, and it was also one of the funnier episodes of Seinfeld. So, but I just wanted to throw that out there. I don't know if you watch Seinfeld, Joel, but. That is a memorable episode.
See, and I'll have to look that one up. I don't really... I've seen a few episodes of Seinfeld, not really my thing. But, no, it's always a weird thing. It's a weird thing because you've got... The main villain is a Native American kid, but, like...
Yeah.
It's clear that other people... Like, his grandfather has a pretty memorable moment, like, where it's basically all about they get all their they get so many supplies from George Kennedy's general store, and they're giving George like a bunch of like priceless heirlooms as sort of an IOU, like, this, keep these until we can afford to pay you. And so it's a really nice moment of, like, you know, of people relying on each other to, like, hold together a community. So
yeah.
you've got like a tribe that is obviously, like, really involved in the community outside it, that's while still being, like, holding fast to their tribal history and community. And the villain is a Native American kid who's trying to just, like, throw that away and be part of, like, the modern world. And what kills him is a racist representation of, like, of Native Americans. I can't figure out what the hell the actual, like, moral is.
I think clearly
moral is just to rob people.
yeah, clearly it's just, you know, a revenge tale at the heart of it all, you know, as Chief Woodenhead is one by one, you know, seeking revenge for the murder of his owners. So, but another one real quick in Creepshow 2 that stands out because I've got a couple of movies to talk about here, but I wanted to touch on the episode of this film that the Hitchhiker. And I think this was one of the more I guess for me the one of the more comedic tales in the film, as the lady on the dark and stormy night runs over the hitchhiker and he keeps coming back asking the lady for a ride, and I think not as strong as some of the other stories in the film, but it stands out to me just because of, I guess it's more humor-based. It has a tragic ending, of course, but throughout the film, it's more of a dark comedy.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's got that black comedy and karmic death element that's very, very much old horror comics. And, you know, it's more openly funny. I mean, you know, the dead hitchhiker keeps showing up and saying thanks for the ride, lady, and well, he's just like just hanging on to this car with like a vice grip, and that like she's just like crashing into things, slamming into trees, and like he's just holding on, like it's just a classic kind of like old horror tale. And there's like a lot of old horror tales, a lot of old like, you know, 8-page comic tales with a karmic ending basically just have the moral, don't be a dick. And here it's a little more sympathetic to its lead because, I mean, she's not a great person. She's cheating on her husband at the beginning. Like, but it's more clear that when she accidentally hits the hitchhiker, like, she takes off just partly because she's so freaked out by what happened. I mean, yes. There's an element, obviously, she's trying to avoid being found out that, like, that she wasn't where she told her husband she would be. She, of course, avoiding, like, jail time for hitting someone, for manslaughter. you know, but by the same token, the way the actress plays it, she's just, I think part of it is she's just so, like, so freaked out that this happened that it's just a fight or flight response.
Right, yeah. So definitely, So definitely, one of the more memorable aspects of Creepshow 2 was that story, just for its dark humor. Yeah,
absolutely. Creepshow 2, I think, is definitely worth checking out. Like we said, it's not as good as the original, but I think it's very much worth a look.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's talk about Quicksilver Highway here, Joel. Now, I haven't seen much of this, if anything. I've been looking into it, and I can't recall ever having seen this, but of course, you know, this is, as far as film adaptations go, this is probably one of his more lesser-known works, and I was hoping that maybe you could shed some light on it for us, Joel.
Yeah, Quicksilver Highway, first of all, it's directed by Mick Garris, who worked on a lot of King adaptations. I mean, he's most known for doing The Stand. He also did the remake of The Shining that was closer to his closer to King's own novel. He did Riding the Bullet, which I've never seen. I forget if that was an anthology film or actually it was based on a novella. He did Desperation and Bag of Bones. He's worked with Stephen King a lot. Quicksilver Highway is half Stephen King. It's two stories, one which was a Clive Barker one. We won't deal with that so much. And the other one is Chattery Teeth, and it's got a framing device of traveling showman, traveling sort of almost carnival Barker type, who picks up a hitchhiking, like, recently married couple, and he's telling Mr. And he tells the Stephen King story too, and his name is Aaron Quicksilver, which I don't know why, and he's played by Christopher Lloyd, who seems to be dressed like a 90s industrial goth with like leather pants So if you've ever had like a Doc Brown fetish and you just want to see him work that ass, like, this is your chance.
Oh my gosh.
But he's awesome in this because it's Christopher Lloyd, and giving him license to be insane is amazing. But this, the King story here is one of King's worst short stories, I think. Remember what I said about bottom of the barrel King being like taking an object and make it kill someone?
Right, exactly.
This is Chattery Teeth, and it's actually what you think it is, those sort of lined up walking teeth.
Yeah, that sounds great concept.
It's not promising, obviously.
This is akin to the pie and thinner.
Yeah, this guy is a salesman. He picks up a hitchhiker who tries to rob him. He accidentally crashes his car when they're like struggling, and he had bought some weird chattering teeth, or I guess a clerk gave them to him because they weren't working, but they're a very weird or a sized pair or something, and they come to life after the car wreck, and they start like eating the carjacker, and they're dragging him off into the desert, and the teeth end up protecting, like he goes back to the same convenience store later on and finds the teeth again and buys them because they're going to protect him.
I think if we thought the Mangler was high concept stuff, then we're going to be blown away by this story.
I mean, it's kind of like a King, like I said, Bottom of the Barrel King is like, let's take like a random object I saw in a store somewhere and make it evil. Yeah. It's like the monkey from Skeleton Crew that got used on the cover of that. I don't know.
The wind up toy of the chattering teeth was a popular item for kids back in like maybe the 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. I don't get why you wind up and watch these teeth chatter, why that's what the appeal of that is. No, I don't know. If I was a kid back then, I just don't understand the appeal of the wind up chattering teeth, you know?
Life before Nintendo, man.
Yeah, let's want to play some stickball. probably a weaker, a much weaker King story. Or probably, the way you're describing it, Joel, I would think that this story is probably even lower on the rung than the Mangler itself, or even or even thinner.
Yeah, to his credit, it's not like a horror story, I guess. It's more just like a weird incident story. I mean, like the fact that he's kind of passing out in the middle of a desert. So like, there's some ambiguity as to whether it's actually happening or he's just like the guy, the carjacker died in the wreck and the guy's just sort of attributing his own survival to these things. Like, so there's some ambiguity there. I mean, I wouldn't say it's like as bad as Thinner because King tried to squeeze a novel out of Thinner. Like, at the very least, this is just a weird little short story. And I think, and maybe I need to read it again because the actual image of the chattering teeth is like, such a weird, ridiculous little image that maybe I missed the tone of it the first time around when I was a kid.
I think we've talked about, and we keep referring to Thinner, even though we have nothing to say about it.
we're just desperately trying to wring some meaning out of it.
We're gonna devote a whole show to Thinner one of these days.
It's gonna be 2 hours of us talking about how we have nothing to say about Thinner.
Yeah, exactly. Well, with that being said, Joel, let's so we touched on a lot of his anthology stuff here. I think let's go ahead and recommend a couple of King adaptations for the listeners then. What do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll go for some ones that maybe they've seen, maybe they haven't, but probably not one. Like, obviously we're outside the realm of King stories that Stranger Things flagrantly rip off.
Yeah. So then let's get into the double bill spill then, Joel. And I'll kick it off. I'll kick it off here with a film from 1985. Corey Haim, Gary Busey. It's Silver Bullet.
Yes.
Which is, yeah, Silver Bullet. This is actually one of his, in my opinion, one of his better film adaptations. Basically, Corey Haim is a handicapped kid, and Gary Busey's his uncle, and Corey Haim believes the local preacher to be a werewolf, and it turns out he's actually not crying wolf, because he actually is one. They have trouble proving it in parts of the film, but of course, that's par for the course in movies like this, and it's just the final scene of the film, you know, was really, you know, balls to the wall, just tremendous stuff. And I really think that Silver Bullet probably should go down as one of, you know, if not top three, but maybe top five King adaptations.
Yeah, that's a pretty big statement, but I can totally understand it, because of course you.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, one we didn't mention, which probably doesn't quite fit in here. Of course, Shawshank would be his best.
I was just thinking of horror. I mean, but yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of people say The Shining. I'm a big Carrie fan, but yeah, I love Silver Bullet, and partly because it's based on one of his, it's based on a novella of his, Cycle of the Werewolf. So there was really.
Yes.
It's a simple setup. There's a lot of room to really, like, I feel like this is almost like the better version of Salem's Lot, where it didn't like focus has much on trying to give you this whole sort of social landscape of this town like Salem's Lot did, which may have worked better in the novel. I thought that it kind of dragged the film down a lot in that case.
There are quite a few characters in the film. You know, it's a small town. Of course, everyone there's quirky little characters throughout the story. You know, the main focus, of course, is on, you know, the werewolf aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's just condensed in a way that I think benefits the story. Because Salem's Lot itself is kind of a thin story, but there's just so many characters, and it's trying to get you into this Peyton Place kind of drama. So Silver Bullet just, it's tighter, it's more focused. Like, of course, you've got the great Everett McGill played Everett McGill.
Yes, I did forget about him, but unfortunately for that, Everett McGill, pretty much awesome in everything he does. He's kind of like Brad Dourif, you know.
Yeah, he's just always so weird and intense and funny. It's just like he's such a strange and intimidating presence.
He was a great fit for the original Twin Peaks run.
Yeah, and People Under the Stairs, of course, and like when you've got not only Corey Haim, who's already like, you know, not exactly Schwarzenegger up there, but Corey Haim in a wheelchair. It's like,
yeah, I love how you know, Gary Busey, you know, within the film, that, you know, his uncle Gary helps him soup up his wheelchair. And you know, Corey Haim getting around town like that. It's comedic to me, and just watching Corey Haim rock it through town. But little great interactions are between Corey Haim and Gary Busey. I'm sure there was a lot of blow done backstage between the two.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. It's a fun, quirky little movie. It's totally overlooked, I think. You know, partly because it's just such a straightforward idea, and people, I feel like a lot of King fans don't necessarily have much interest in the straightforward ideas from King, because he's so big into doing interconnected stuff and, like, you know, repeated tales, and these that involve like all the people in these small areas, and then how it affects every single one. And this is just a cool, fun, weird little werewolf tale.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's my pick, my portion on the double bill spill.
And my pick is one our listeners might be a little more familiar with, and it's the Stephen King film directed by the man himself, Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive.
Now, yes, sir. Great film.
And,
great film.
For those of our listeners who haven't seen the trailers or the original poster or anything, like, they made a huge deal in the promotion of this that Stephen King was directing it. Like, he shows up on the poster, like, he's got, like, puppet strings that are connected to the cast beneath him. Like, they're trying to, like, portray him as, like, this weird sort of almost crazy storytelling, like, minstrel hermit who's like running the world. Like, one of the trailers, he's talking to the audience. He's like talking about how he thought the only man who could do a Stephen King film properly was himself, and he's talking that, like, if you've never heard Stephen King talk, he's got this weird nasal voice, which I'm sure was not helped by cocaine. And he's saying, you know, I kind of liked it. I'm going to scare the hell out of you. And it's so insane. This is what I refer to as the most squeedily D movie of all time, because it is so, the whole thing is like a bad guitar riff. It is awesome. You know, it's Emilio Estevez and a bunch of random weirdos at a truck stop. Gus from Breaking Bad gets electrocuted by a pinball machine. Unfortunately, we don't have, like, all the original footage, because some of the original gore scenes that he had to cut to get that R rating were apparently so grotesque that they made George Romero puke. I'm not sure how anecdotal that is, but apparently there's the scene where the kid on the bike gets run over by the steamroller, and they had, like, a bursting blood effect that actually made George Romero sick.
Oh, my poor George Romero.
You know. Oh, sorry. But there's so many weird scenes. Like, I love, like, just the montage at the beginning of, like, the machines going crazy everywhere. The, like, you know, ATM calling the guy an asshole. The drawbridge lifting off. The cars going everywhere. The dump truck, like, dropping, like, killer watermelons.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a Coke spitting out Coke cans, full Coke cans at like 100 miles an hour, braining people.
Yeah, oh my god! Yeah, the watermelons crush Marla Maples, I believe.
Yeah, so I mean, just, I don't know. The only thing missing was a toaster coming down on someone's hand while reaching in for their toast.
The film takes the stupid concept and does stupid, awesome things with it. There's, like, the villain is, of course, a big truck with a giant, like, green goblin on the floor.
Yeah, it's got the green goblin.
It's like a toy company truck, I think, right?
Yeah, I believe so. It's got to be. It's got to be with the green goblin on the truck. So, I mean, that's an awesome way to depict that truck as, like, the leader of the pack, you know, give it a menacing facade, you know, and it works.
No, it's awesome. It's like in Jaws 2 when they wanted the shark to be more threatening, so they had half its face burnt in the gasoline boat explosion. a step away from giving the shark a fan the opera mask. Giving a truck a spooky green goblin face. It's so brilliant. Like, of course, there's an awesome, ridiculous AC/DC soundtrack. Just everything.
I did have the soundtrack, though. Made Who, and
everything. Awesome. Like, they've got, like, a catch of, like, you know, firearms and rocket launchers for some reason that they have access to. Like, Yardley Smith, we mentioned earlier, she's here. I don't know if this is how she and Steven met or not.
She was so annoying. Oh, there it is! I know. And they were just married, and she's already berating the poor.
Oh,
sapling.
My God. All the characters are total cartoons. It's amazing.
isn't Pat Hingle in this
movie? Pat Hingle owns the diner. His name is Bubba.
Yeah. That's right. I love Pat Hingle.
He's awesome. Awesome. Like, just everything is, like, it's just like taking that sort of Assault on Precinct 13, Night of the Living Dead plot, being stuck in a rural area inside one building, being harassed by forces outside, and just making it 80s metal. Totally ridiculous. It's,
yeah.
I mean, probably a lot of our listeners have seen it, but, you know, for those of us, for those of them who haven't, for those of them who, you know, may have seen their kids and forgot all about it or just remember some of the bigger moments, it's worth it.
Come on, millennials. You know, it's streaming on your iPhone somewhere. Look it up.
Watch out if your iPhone starts sprouting a green goblin face. We're launching Kangs at you.
Yeah, maybe Siri starts giving you bad directions.
Right, something. Off a cliff. No, this is definitely a film I would love for, like, a stupid remake to... I feel like if they did a remake now, it wouldn't be goofy and funny. It would just be like a... It would be like Snakes on a Plane, a stupid... I can't believe I... And this is probably the first time in 10 years someone's mentioned that thing. But, like, a stupid concept that could be really funny and ridiculous, but you just kind of made a generic action film out of it.
Yeah, you know, and... You're talking about, you know, someone remaking this. Don't be given Hollywood ideas because you know they're fresh.
Oh, yeah, but like maybe they'll accidentally give it to a director with a sense of humor and they'll make something fun out of it.
Right. So yeah, Maximum Overdrive, quite awesome, and a good solid recommendation from you there, Joel. I think we've run the gamut of the King discussion.
What's amazing is that there's so many, like, there's so many we didn't even talk about because they just, like, made adaptation after adaptation after adaptation.
And they're still doing it. And they're still making them. So, I mean, Stephen King's material is rife for filmmaking. And there's even some adaptations that you wondered, how the hell are they going to make this into a movie? You know, because, you know, we had, and stuff we didn't get into, we had, like, I believe they're making Gerald's Game into a movie, and Dolores Claiborne was even made into a film. And so, I mean, you had some stuff that I thought was unfilmable actually make it to the big screen. And I guess it's just an ode to King's work being so popular that people are still, you know, shelling out money to want to make his books into films.
His name carries so much weight. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Say what you will about, you know, his work. So there's a lot of there's about as many non-fans as there are fans, I would reckon, because, you know, I've seen a lot of criticism online and in other places as well. But about his material, how you feel about it personally. Personally, I'm a fan of his earlier stuff. I haven't gotten into a lot of his latter day stuff, just because I've fallen out of reading books. And there's a lot of stuff I haven't caught up with. But a lot of his earlier stuff are really classic film adaptations.
Yeah, and something I'd just love to bring up briefly. One of the coolest things about Stephen King, I'm not like the fan I was when I was a young kid, and he was like the greatest man in the world to me, but he may still have this policy, but he had a long-standing policy that any film student who wanted to direct an adaptation of, like, one of his shorts for a film school or for any other purpose only had to pay him $1 for the rights to do so. And one of the awesome early filmmakers who took advantage of that was Frank Darabont, who of course later made Shawshank.
Of course, yeah. So, we all start somewhere, and that's where Darabont started. So that's a good callback there, Joel. Yeah. So I guess that'll be a show for this week, and it was a lively discussion. And, of course, I always appreciate your input, Joel. Thank you very
much. Oh, yours too, man.
Yeah. And we will go away for a week, but we'll be back next week. Until then, remember your mom and pop video store, because it is the cornerstone of all nostalgia, especially my own. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you.
Under the arch double with a steamboat, ancient goblins and wallows come at the grand light making a sound. The smell of death is all around. And at night when the cold no one cares, nobody knows. To the sacred place. This ain't a dream, I can't escape. Molding some fangs that are picking up bones. Spirits moaning among the tombstones. And at night when the moon is bright, someone cries something ain't right. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. To live my life again. I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. I feel a chill. Victor is grinning, flesh is riding away. Skeleton dance, I curse these days. And at night when the wolves cry out, listen close then you can hear me shout. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live.